contraception. Our library has a little book called The Catholic Case for Contraception that actually includes a lot of Catholic intellectuals. This was written in the late 60s. Folks who disagreed with human a vitae. And in fact, it is interesting to note that in terms of the commission that worked on this for several years for the Pope, the majority came out in favor of contraception. And so Pope Paul actually surprised people by going with the minority report in terms of affirming this. And so that, you can read the document, the majority papal commission in that book. So one argument in favor of contraception is the lesser evil argument. And this is essentially the idea of saying, okay, even if contraception is something morally wrong, isn't it better to practice contraception than to put somebody in a position, for example, where they have a child and then they abort the child? Right? So doesn't it make sense, especially when you're talking about, you know, in our world today, this is almost kind of a practical argument. You know, if teenagers are sexually active, it's much better to give them access to contraception than to put them in a position where a child is going to be brought into existence, but then potentially aborted. I was talking to Kurt yesterday. By the way, did you guys know if you got this flyer? Anybody know? People know what kind of a flyer I'm talking about? Yeah. Isn't February is what?
National Condom
Month. Okay, so apparently being at Kuiper, he only got the flyer. I guess when he was at Grand Valley, he got the flyer and a couple hundred condoms to pass out. So there it is. But this is basically the argument that contraception is bad, but it's not as bad as other things that could potentially result from this. And so this is in some sense the lesser evil argument. There are, I think, a couple of problems, though, with making any kind of lesser evil argument, not just this one. I think sometimes we need to realize that when we talk about a lesser evil argument, the distinction here is really that we are willing to tolerate evil versus doing evil. And so the lesser evil argument, as it's properly constructed, is not that it's sometimes okay to do less evil things instead of doing more evil things. The point is, it's better to tolerate evil things, including suffering, rather than doing evil. So let me give you an example of how this would work. So you know, this is where it gets, you know, in other ethical issues, I think sometimes can help us think through some of these basic principles. So the Christian case, for example, against torture holds that it is better to tolerate evil than to do evil. And so this is part of why a Christian would look at, let's say, are there terrorists in the world? Yes. Do those terrorists know information that can harm us? Yes. But if torture is morally wrong, then you're never justified in doing that wrong, even if it might bring about less suffering. It is better to suffer evil, better to suffer than to sin. Right now, this is probably counterintuitive because a lot of people in our world, including Christians, would say, really, you should try to avoid suffering at all costs. And so you do what you have to do to make that happen. But the lesser evil argument is more about tolerating evil, not about doing evil. Because I think if we have our moral theology correct, we would say the good end can never justify an evil means to that end. Okay, so it's fine to say, well, it is good to want to avoid suffering. It is good to want to avoid a terrorist attack, but there are moral and immoral ways of doing that. And if you do it in an immoral way, in one sense, you're no better than a terrorist because you're willing to do this immoral thing to lead you to a moral end. And so if an act is truly wrong, no good consequences can justify that act. And so this is part of the debate then, you know, when we're thinking about contraception. That is a point that's contended, but if contraception is truly wrong, then it doesn't matter what kind of end goal you put out there, you can't make it right. Now, this is, I think there are, this is where there are a couple of points where I think you could make a case for contraception. Potentially, in an instance where the mother's life would be in danger, right? There could be a case where a doctor would say your life, life of the mother, is severely threatened if you have another pregnancy. That, I think, is one potential area where I'm open to thinking then about the moral status of contraception because of that. So when we think about this, we'll come back to this point and think it through in a little bit more detail. But we have to put it in that context. But again, part of what I would challenge here is not that doing something wrong leads to something good, but that in this circumstance, the use of contraception would not be wrong. Right? So I'm not saying, well, there's this one case where you can do something wrong to get to a good end, but there's this one case where I'm challenging whether this would actually qualify as something wrong. Does that make sense? Question? Okay. Did I see a hand?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Another potential argument is that of the principle of totality. And so the principle of totality essentially says that the procreative mandate applies to the whole of married life, not to each act of intercourse. And so the idea here is that if a couple is open to children, it's okay to be open to children maybe at a later point or at another point in marriage, and this applies to, you know, your openness in general, not the openness of each particular marital act, right? So if a couple, you know, if you get married and you use contraceptives for a few years, but then have children, it's not a big deal. Why? Because the procreative mandate applies to the whole of the marriage and not just to each particular act. That's the principle of totality. You can see something like this operating, even in medical ethics, when we say it's okay to sacrifice a partial good for the total good, right? If you know, your a toe or a foot becomes completely infected, you don't say, well, it's intrinsically wrong to cut off your foot. There may be cases where you sacrifice that part for the good of the whole, okay? And so the whole still has good health, even though the part has been sacrificed. And so some would say that this is in some ways an analogy to this, that there's this part of the marriage, some of these marital acts are not open to children, but others of them are. And so because of others of them are, the marriage as a whole kind of counts in terms of being open there. A key question then is to ask this, is each act of intercourse a part of a whole, or does each act of intercourse have an independent value as well? So here we would recognize in the case of amputation, it's okay to sacrifice a partial good for the total good, but think about something else. When we think about individual humans, especially from a Christian standpoint, we typically don't say that to sacrifice someone's life for the good of a whole is an okay moral thing. Right? So this is why generally Christians are against just elective abortion. I look at this and I say, this is going to severely hamper my life. And so for the good of my life and for the good of maybe even our marriage, we're not ready for children right now, we're willing to have an abortion. You can't sacrifice one life for the good of the whole. It doesn't work that way because each individual life has its own intrinsic value. And so we don't look at people as just expendable. You can't just send people to concentration camps or work camps because they happen to just disagree with your government. And, well, we can sacrifice millions of people for the good of the whole of society. It's not like that. Each individual person has its own worth. And so this is part of the question that when we think about each act of intercourse, is it more like this part and whole or like this part and whole? Where clearly the individual human is part of the whole, but they also have their own intrinsic worth apart from the connection to the whole. And so maybe one way to get at this, when we think about marriage, would we apply this principle to other dimensions of the marital act? So think about last time we talked about married love has these four dimensions: free, total, faithful, and fruitful. Okay, so part of what objectors want to say is fruitful should apply to the marriage as a whole, but not necessarily each act of intercourse. What would happen if we did that with the qualification of free? In other words, entered into consensually. Would you say as long as most acts of intercourse between a husband and wife are consensual, then it's okay? Or would we say, no, each and every act needs to be consensual, needs to be entered into freely? I would say each and every act would have to have that qualification. Or if we were to say, most acts of intercourse should express faithfulness, but sometimes, right, and there are people out there who say, sometimes it's good for a marriage if you kind of go sleep around, right? Explore different horizons so you come back, with a fresh outlook and, whatever. However, people try to justify this. I think most of us would say no. Faithfulness is not something that you can apply to most acts, but applies to each and every one. And so part of the question then is, if you take these four characteristics, it seems like that with the other three, we do want to say it applies to each and every act that this is there. And so then each and every act should also be at least open to potential fruitfulness, that each and every act should not intentionally shut down that openness to fruitfulness. So those are a couple of arguments, and we're going to look at what Hollinger says in just a minute about this from another direction. Do you have questions about either of these two arguments? All right. Yes.
I think it's similar to what I've said before, but in this context, where the fruitfulness in some case could be literal, is it possible that in all cases, that in each act it is figuratively fruitful, but in some acts it is literally fruitful?
I think.
Because then they're both kind of working together, other than separating.
Yeah, well, each act by definition is, unless you're, I don't know if you want to say lucky or unlucky, each act is not going to be literally fruitful, but each act should be literally open to fruitful. I think when we say fruitful, it doesn't mean you have to have kids every time you engage in intercourse, but that you're not actively inhibiting that as a result. And so I think they're tied together. And I think clearly there is, I think there's fruit that flows from this that is more than just children. But I don't want to get rid of the literal openness to fruitfulness.
This is diving into a little bit different, but what doesn't even the rhythm method actively inhibit, children, because you're choosing to do it at certain times and not at other times, so as to be less fruitful.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a minute. That's the start of the next PowerPoint. But that's a great question. All right, a couple of things in terms of I just want to hit these briefly. Things that Humanae Vitae mentions in terms of negative consequences. We touched on this a bit at the end of our discussion last time. That contraception increases marital infidelity, right? And by the way, even though we're talking about contraception, I haven't said this falls under the heading of this, but sterilization also is a form of contraception, right? Whether it's on the part of the man or the woman. And so I will tell you, it is really strange when you have four kids like I do, that people who you would not consider close friends will randomly ask you if you are going to have certain procedures. I kid you not, it's really strange. I'm like, really, you're going to ask me that? Interesting. Or they won't even ask me something. They will just say something like, snip, snip. I'm like, really? I feel this is a kind of a personal violation. Right? That it's just kind of like, it's just out there. But again, part of what's interesting is most people don't even think about that as a potentially moral thing. It's a procedure. Marital infidelity is one thing it mentions, and we talked about this at the end of class period last time in terms of its connection to virtue ethics. So the point is that repeated use of contraception does make us into certain kind of people and make us think about our sexuality in certain kind of ways. It also mentions a lack of incentive to keep the moral law. And so in one sense, there is an element of fear here that you know that the natural outcome of this could be a child. That, you know, people don't usually, they're not usually thinking 100% rationally anyway. But it at least is one element in this. There's a tendency then to reduce people to instruments, primarily because it's perfectly fine to say pleasure is one of the end results of sex. But when you cut off some of the other ends, then that becomes the primary or the sole end. And so that oftentimes can become the focus. This one is a very interesting one as well, I think. If the individual is capable of making decisions for their greater good, why not public authorities? Why is it wrong for the Chinese government to say, you can only have one child? Right? Aren't they, in some sense, just doing on a larger scale what the individual or the couple may be doing for themselves, saying, you know, for the greater good, we need to be sure that we're limiting this. Should it be, as happened, you know, even in this country, should it be that people who are deemed unfit to reproduce should be sterilized? And who decides who exactly is unfit to reproduce? This gets pretty tricky. But if we say that this should be subject to human will and intelligence, part of the point is, well, whose will, whose intelligence? And so then you have, I think I posted this article, if you want to go find it, I posted it under the resources page for Sakai. Within a few years, it's estimated that China is going to have about 33 million more men than women. And they're trying to address this because guess what? That is a recipe for severe social upheaval. So that's, you sort of realize that this planning sometimes doesn't always go as planned.
That's just because they opted to have a male child versus a female child?
Yeah, a big part of it.
Culturally, a male child was more to their desire.
Yeah. And so, so that's a big factor as well. Because often if you can only have one child and you find out the child was a female, it's going to be aborted. And so, so you end up in this scenario.
In more recent years, they made it illegal to find out the gender of your child to combat that.
Yeah. And just recently they changed their policy. This has been in the news just in the last month. That this has been changed, but that's an extreme example of what happens, I think, when you turn children and procreation over to the state and say this is the state's job. Yeah.
Just a little on that subject. We have a Chinese exchange student at my house right now, and she really struggled when she first came here, and she just opened up to my mom about how she just doesn't understand why she's not treated more special. Because she's a girl, and she's like, I'm just not used to being treated this way. I should be treated more special because I'm a girl. And my mom was like, well, I don't understand, but she goes, but I'm a girl. And we were like, well, yeah, there are a lot of girls here. So yeah. I guess there's kind of a princess culture thing that happened for her in Shanghai, where she was very treated very special because she was a girl.
Yeah. Yeah, because it does. So this is the article talks about the fact that then what it does is any woman pretty much has the opportunity of marrying up. Mm-hmm. And so then you have these, especially out in the countryside, you have these large bachelor villages where it's just all men, most of them living in poverty, who aren't going to attract are going to attract a woman. So that, I mean, that's an interesting to
she
hear
was
that.
So confused.
That, yeah.
But she didn't mean it like to be rude or anything. She just didn't understand why we weren't treating her more special.
Yeah.
And we were confused as well, so I had to kind of bridge that, try to explain
yeah.
to my mom why that was happening.
Yeah. Figure out how that works. That's interesting. The positive consequences, Humanae Vitae talks about the fact that when we think about marital relations, and that they're called to be an expression of true and free love. And so, in other words, it's not just experienced as this compulsion. Right? Certainly, there's a sense of real passion and desire that we talked about earlier in class, that in some sense, a sense of out-of-controlness. But what this is emphasizing is the fact that my attraction to you is not just purely physical. And our engagement in intercourse is not just this kind of base animal draw, but there's something more there. It also talks about the fruit of self-discipline. That is, as we learn to be self-disciplined in one area, that inevitably affects the rest of our character and the rest of our lives. And so it's again, we live in a culture that very much says indulge your desires. That you can't restrict that just to the sexual arena. That inevitably is going to affect how people function and operate in other ways. And so it talks about integrity in self and relationships, so that this is, again, within the individual, there's a sense of body and soul working together, that sense of integrity. There's a sense of husband and wife working together. And there's also a sense that this affects their children. That being these kind of people is going to, in some sense, again, there is no, Lord knows, there is no recipe for forming and shaping children into children, not machines. But if you have children with virtuous parents, it's at least more likely that those children will be themselves virtuous, as opposed to we're all sinners, but there's a difference there in terms of this training in virtue or training in vice. All right. Here is today's PowerPoint. You can hand these around. And as we think about, as we continue, thinking about some of the potential objections, what I want to do is walk through this key question raised last time and this time in terms of natural family planning versus contraception, because this is something Humanae Vitae talks about. Paragraph 16 says natural family planning is okay, contraception is not. In other words, so we'll talk about whether if this difference works. I'm going to talk a little bit about how natural family planning works. So get ready to talk about bodies, everybody. Brace yourselves. Okay. All right, good. Just so you know that's coming. And then I want to spend a little bit of time thinking through the arguments made by Hollinger today. So what's the difference? When we talk about natural family planning, I'll explain this in a little bit more detail, but the idea is that natural family planning understands especially a woman's fertility cycle and uses that cycle to get pregnant or to avoid pregnancy. And so when people think about natural family planning as a means to avoid pregnancy, part of the point is to recognize there are times of the month when a woman is infertile. And so intercourse is reserved for those times of the month if a couple is trying to space or to limit children, but it is not intentionally contracept, in other words, to interfere with the marital act in a way that would throw conception off. So this is Karl Barth, who Hollinger mentions here. I thought, well, I like a lot of Karl Barth, but I thought this is typical Protestant. Just list four things that are different and say they're all the same. So four possibilities: complete sexual abstinence, sexual intercourse in the naturally infertile periods, and so this would be natural family planning, coitus interruptus. Do I need to explain Latin? Okay, you interrupt the act. This is sometimes called the withdrawal method, to make sure that the seed is spilled not in the womb, but on the ground, also called onanism. So onanism, coitus interruptus, right? You can see why people are trying to find like other ways to avoid explicitly saying what they're saying. And use of contraceptives. So these are four different possibilities. And Hallinger mentions that Bart essentially says all of these draw on human arrangement and control. Therefore, they are all the same. Okay. Now I think he's right in that they're all the same in that they draw on human arrangement and control. But is that why Humanae Vitae says what it does? Right? I think this is one of the questions to ponder here. Because if you think about all four of these, or if you think about the experience of different couples utilizing all four of these, I'm just going to say abstinence is a lot different from actually having sex. Right? Can I get an amen? Right? Those are different, right? And that similarly, sexual intercourse that uses contraceptives is different from sexual intercourse that doesn't. There's a difference. These are not all the same. And so part of what you have to figure out is what exactly is meant by this, and is this really, even if we say they all fit under this category, are we still fine with saying morally they're all the same? Clearly, physically, they're not all the same. So I think we have to think that through.
Yeah, so
is there an next man up?
Oh, is there?
There you go.
All right. Sorry, I should make an extra one. I keep forgetting. So when we think about this, what is the difference? Okay, very basically, we come back to this distinction between ends versus means. That usually, when you think about all kinds of moral issues, the focus oftentimes is not simply on the end or the goal, but the real morality comes into play when we talk about the means. How do you get to this end or goal? So, for example, you could have two men who have the goal of providing for their family. That's a very honorable goal. That's a good goal. But getting a job at a bank is a lot different from robbing the bank. And so you don't say, well, you know, both of these have the same end goal, both of these have the same desire, so really, they're all the same. Right? They're not, because the means actually is very important. You can see this in other ethical issues in the Christian tradition. When you talk about something like a just war, the whole point is that, well, for starters, you have to have a worthwhile end that you're fighting for. But usually when you're talking about what makes a war just or not, a lot of it has to do with how you fight that war. Is it legitimate to just obliterate large groups of civilians for the purpose of defeating even somebody like Hitler? Well, the just war tradition says no. That it is actually better to lose a war, to suffer evil, than to commit sin in the process of trying to bring about a good end. And so it very much has to do with means. And this is, you know, when we ask at its base, you know, what is the difference between natural family planning and contraception? It is the difference between actively using contraceptives and not. Those are two different means to reach a certain end. And so to think about, again, from the perspective of Humanae Vitae, what's wrong with contraception? It's not the use of human intelligence. It is fine for human beings to use their intelligence to engage in all kinds of medical, biological, physical issues. And so it's, you know, the point here is not that, well, you're using your brain to kind of figure out what's going on. That's not the issue. And it's also not the desire to space children or temporarily avoid having children. Remember, Humanae Vitae does not say every time you engage in sex, you should have a child, or that everyone should be, you know, as soon as a baby is born, the parent should instantly desire to have another child. So it's not morally wrong to space children or to temporarily avoid having children. Now, here's where this does get interesting, because when we talk about natural family planning, the point of this is not to avoid having children at all. That's what, you know, we talk about, we don't say, this is where it gets confusing when we talk about natural, because some people in our culture we hear natural is not artificial. Okay, so as long as I'm not using contraceptives, even if I never have kids, then that's okay. No, the teaching is that children are connected, are part of the goods of marriage. And this is why in traditional marriage vows, it includes questions about being open to children if the Lord blesses. Because traditionally, if you'd said, you know, we're going to get married, but we're not going to have kids, the teaching would have been, well, you shouldn't get married, because that's part of this whole deal. And so if someone were to use natural family planning for the goal of avoiding children altogether, then that certainly would go against the teaching. So here, this is almost the principle of totality in reverse, right? That if you were to say the total intention for marriage and intercourse is not to have children, then each act could be hypothetically open to fruitfulness, but you could, using your intelligence, use natural family planning in a way to potentially avoid ever having children. And that would be wrong, not in terms of each individual act, but in terms of your own inner motive regarding that act. Does that make sense? Things get really, you know, this is where when you ask, is something right or wrong, it gets really complicated. Because you're talking about the objective act, you're thinking about your inner motive, you're thinking about all of these other things. Another difference, I mean, this I think is interesting, is to talk about the experiential difference. How many people does it take to contracept? One. Right? Yes. Right? It takes one person to contracept. It takes, and by the way, I mean, do you guys realize that even because of how we think about individuals and individual choice, that a woman could seek an abortion without ever consulting her husband, right, or boyfriend, or whoever the father is, right? That's perfectly, so even when we think about contraception, it's the same kind of thing. It only takes the will of one partner, man or woman, to contracept. Natural family planning takes two. It takes two to tango. And natural family plan. I don't know how to work that. Anyway, and there's also an experiential difference. This is very interesting. I think that oftentimes when people who gravitate toward natural family planning for moral and theological purposes, and people who gravitate toward contraception, especially for ideological purposes, typically describe that experience in very different ways. Oftentimes, a focus on contraception, especially in our culture, is driven by an emphasis on freedom, autonomy, control, and choice. Those who are drawn to natural family planning for moral and theological reasons typically do so for theological reasons of understanding human limits, but also human cooperation with God. You don't often get people who fall into the ideological camp and the theological camp kind of just swapping back and forth, right? It's very clear that these are two different worldviews that shape these practices for people in those camps. Again, I think there are a whole host of people in the middle who it's just more assumed as a matter of convenience or medicine or biology. I get this. In terms of the experiential difference as well, usually contraception, the burden of that does often fall upon the woman in a relationship. In natural family planning, this is something where both husband and wife have to be aware and have to have a level of understanding and a level of buy-in to what's going on. And so it very much is a cooperative effort as opposed to being a singular effort. So if we think about natural family planning as morally permissible, this is where it's what exactly is... If people would say, well, natural family planning is wrong, why would it be wrong? Because when we look at natural family planning, I think this is a cogent argument for saying it's morally permissible. Not having intercourse for a variety of reasons is permissible. Right? So temporary abstinence happens all the time in marriage for different reasons. Whether it's sickness, somebody's absent, inconvenient, you know, your house is full of people. Right? I mean, so you wouldn't say it's morally wrong to abstain. Right? You say, yeah, that's probably a good time to abstain. Also, again, this is part of the point, even in Humanae Vitae, it says it's permissible to space children and to limit family size. Now, I think even here that there is a level of pastoral wisdom and application to say, I think our tendency in our culture is probably to err too far on limiting in terms of children rather than being open. And part of that is just for in terms of convenience or expense. Right, because kids are expensive. But, I mean, this is where we sometimes don't think about these things, like, kids are expensive, but so are old people. And so this is why, traditionally, for most of human history, people have had children, in part, to help sustain and support them when they're old. And so this is where I think there are some interesting moral arguments here that I think about. So what if somebody... my age, a married couple, chooses not to have any kids? Is that person going to draw on Social Security that my kids are paying into? Yes. Am I going to draw on that? Yes. So part of the reason you feel, this is kind of our societal setup, we're like, well, the government will handle it. Right? Well, the government still needs people, right, to pay into something. Which is why I am a little skeptical anytime somebody offers something free. Right? Free college education for everyone! That would be really nice, but like many other free things, it's not actually free. So how does it, you know, it's like free healthcare for everybody. That sounds really nice, except there is no such thing as free, unless you get your Russ's coupons out, and then usually there is. Those kind of things you can give away, right? That works. So it's morally permissible to space children and family size. There's nothing wrong per se with couples having intercourse or not having intercourse at any particular time. Right? Nobody says, well, you know, it's this time again, it's Thursday, you must have intercourse today, married couples, or you're sinning. That's not how it works. So simply abstaining is not sinful. Again, this is where, you know, if you look at the principle of totality, I think you would say, if you abstained and withheld intercourse from your partner for the totality of your marriage, now we're talking about something that is potentially sinful. But, you know, when you're talking about other lengths of time, not so much. Therefore, it's not wrong to not have intercourse at certain times in order to limit family size or to space children. And so this would be the basic argument for natural family planning is morally permissible, because it doesn't interfere with the act of intercourse. It says, if we're not open to this, we are not going to engage in this act. And so again, even the end goal of spacing children or limiting family size is not something that's intrinsically evil. What's wrong would be the engaging in the act while intentionally altering the physicality of the act, which alters the meaning of the act, that would be the issue.
The intention is still the same as the use of contraception, though, to natural family planning, to not have children at this time.
Right, but that's not morally wrong. What's wrong is not the inner intention. What's wrong is the actual objective act. Right, because what's different about these is not the intention or the goal. What's different is like what I'm doing with my body. And those are two different things. Yeah.
I do know of instances though where natural family planning doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
Like using it as, oh, I don't want to have kids right now, so I'm just wanting to do what I'm infertile.
Yeah.
You're still pretty fertile. And so the chances, like and that's not to say anything against natural, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
There are lots of instances where it just doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, and I think that there are, I'm not going to get in, we're going to get into some of the physical detail, but I think there are more details we could go into. But I think part of the point as well is saying, even if our inner intention is to avoid children at this point, we're still open to that.
Right.
There's still a sense of hospitality there, right, that says, you know, this is our intention, but if it doesn't go that way, yeah, in some sense, you know, that's God's doing, not ours. But we're open to that. Sub, did you have a question? No.
Not anymore.
Okay. Yeah.
So I guess it's like in the reading, there is this, like there's the Lady Mary Pride and the group Quiverful movement. That talks about how they, you know, kind of trust in God in all circumstances.
Yeah.
And they're kind of, from my perspective, from my, I guess, reading, I don't think they're for natural family planning.
Yeah.
And so how would they respond to this as a morally permissible school?
So I think with that kind of movement, the point is not just this kind of argument that you see in Humanae Vitae, but it's the more, it pushes the argument further in terms of saying, the goal should be to have as many children as possible, right? 19 and counting. And that, so I do want to distinguish that from what Humanae Vitae is saying here. And so I think part of the point that they might make is they would say, you know, you think about these different ends of intercourse. Intercourse, it has this procreative goal. It has this unitive goal, and even the goal of pleasure. And it would essentially say that it would take the procreative goal and say that not only should you be open to this, but you should actively be seeking this at every time possible. And so, you know, part of what they do, I think, is take one of those and make it kind of the be-all and end-all. And I don't, you know, I've engaged some of that material, but I don't know exactly. Yeah, I think probably where they would attack this is to say, it is not permissible to space children and limit family size. That you know, the procreative piece is not just that each act should be open to this, but each act should be actively seeking it as much as is possible.
Yeah, because it seemed as if they didn't want to continually seek to procreate, but that they wanted to just trust in God and however many kids he provided.
Yeah, and see, that's where it gets a little bit tricky in terms of how we use natural and artificial in our culture, because I think trusting in God doesn't mean we say, I'm not going to apply my intelligence and will at all, but it means I apply my intelligence and will, but I also understand the limits of what I should do based on that. Whereas this view of trusting God, you know, this is where it gets a little bit simplistic. When it's like, well, I'm just trusting God, right? Okay, well, then why take Tylenol? Like, well, I'm just trusting God that this headache is going to go away.
Yeah.
Right? And if I take Tylenol, it shows that I'm somehow not. When in fact, I would say, well, you know, take your Tylenol. That's an example of why. From a medical perspective, it's inhibiting your functioning in a certain way.
Yeah.
So there's something going wrong that you're trying to correct through the use of intelligence and will. It's not something that, you know, takes you beyond the, you know, the proper balance.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily agree with that idea, but I just was wondering.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the direction that they would go. Yeah.
So I thought of that. So the means of normal contraceptive and contraceptive are wrong because they are actively working against it.
Yeah. Because you're actively prohibit. So from the perspective of the way that John Paul II puts it in terms of the language of the body, you're withholding something, so it's not a total giving, and you are, in essence, attempting to cancel out the fruitful aspect of it. And so that's why he would say it goes wrong. So that's different from saying the body is naturally infertile at certain times, you know, as best we can tell, we're engaging in this activity, but we're not doing anything to stop. We're not contradicting that sign. We're not, you know, producing this kind of countersign.
Except by not doing it.
Well, but me not having sex with my wife is not me violating any of those things. The in terms of free, total, faithful, and fruitful, the point is that when you do engage in intercourse, it should have these things, right? Because otherwise it'd be like, well, why is me not having sex with my wife at this point morally wrong, right? Should I rush home? right? So it's not that it's not that not doing it is somehow morally wrong. There's nothing wrong with not doing it, right? Unless you start to stretch that over the course of like months and years at a time, right? And even then, right, we now there are times when for various reasons that may in fact be the case in a marriage, and it's not morally wrong because of medical or other reasons. Other hands, Sarah?
I was just going to say, it seems like the natural family planning, you're using something that God has already, like, that's how your body works. You're not adding, you're not doing other things, so I think that's why.
Yeah. It's very, I mean, natural family planning, I think the reason more people are drawn to this, I talk about this as going organic in the bedroom. Right? So this is, what? You never like that? Everybody wants to be organic these days, and that's part of what it is. It's saying we're not gonna you know, flood the body with hormones, which, you know, again, by the way, not all women respond well to the hormones here, and so, you know, in some sense, Wendell Berry, who's an agrarian, has these very interesting comparisons with how we treat the body and how we treat the earth, and kind of says this is our solution, right? We kind of dump chemicals on things. Whether it's the fields or our bodies, as a way to address this, and so I think that's one angle on this. All right, let me talk a little bit about the physical side of this, and I'm drawing here from The Art of Natural Family Planning, a book by the Couple League, which is a group that started in part as a result of Humanae Vitae, the call here in Humanae Vitae to say one of the best ways that this gets communicated is when couples engage with other couples around this and talk about this. We want to think about this a little bit, but if you want more detail, that's a place to go to. There's a website, or you can talk to me, and I can maybe say some things, or I can phone a friend, namely my wife. What is this? She's always been better with science anyway, and so sometimes she can explain this a little bit better than I can. But when you think about a woman's monthly cycle, and by the way, every woman's monthly cycle is different. Sometimes people will toss out like 28 days and this, right? Every woman's cycle is different, and so this does not depend on, well, you know, my cycle isn't 28 days, or it's not the right amount of days, so we can't know this. The point is that if you're attentive to yourself, you can start to see how this works. And so there's a recognition that it's not always, you know, proportional in this way, but there are times during the month of infertility. There's times even, you know, here, again, this is not, this chart is maybe more set up in a nice, neat way than it actually works. But you need to realize at the time of ovulation, sperm can live for several days. And so it's not just a matter of like, well, we have to watch out for ovulation day. But there's a time before and after that when you could potentially have a baby. It happens. So when we think about this, what goes on in the body is that you have these estrogen and progesterone levels, and what happens is that at the time of ovulation, when the egg is released, the progesterone levels begin to spike sharply, because progesterone is vital in terms of preparing the uterus for pregnancy. So every cycle, right, this is This is the miracle of life. The body is getting ready, potentially, for new life. And this spike in progesterone is connected to a temperature rise. And so this is one way, then, for a woman to track this, right? This is kind of nice and neat and tidy, where on day 14 out of 28, okay, halfway through, you've got progesterone rise because the egg is released. It could be very different, right? Cycle might be longer, might be a little bit shorter, but this is still something that you can detect in part with the right thermometer, a thermometer that goes down to two decimal places. You know, someone said 97.9, it's telling you 97.92 or 97.45. You can track that. If as a woman you take your temperature at the same time every morning, right, this is where you have to be consistent, otherwise, because your body temperature is going to change at different points. But if you track that, you can see how this happens. I'll give you an example of this chart in a minute. So one thing, you essentially track it in a couple of different ways, three different ways. One is charting your temperature that's connected to this rise in hormone levels. Next part, everybody hang on. Okay. The other things that you're gonna, right? The other things that are tracked, these are our bodies, guys. God made our bodies. This is not, although now in retrospect, I cannot imagine sitting in a college class hearing my professor say this stuff. So. The other things that are connected with this are cervical mucus. Yes, I said it. The cervical opening. And so this is something, again, that a woman can test and track and chart day by day to see that as there is more cervical mucus, as there are certain sensations and characteristics associated with it, that's connected to fertility. And you can chart and see how these things work. Cervix, as you may or may not know or imagine, closed would be more connected with being infertile. Open would be connected with fertility. Okay, so this is what a basic chart looks like. And this is what I think is kind of funny. It's actually the Catholic position, right? Because sometimes people are like, oh, religion and science, the Catholic Church and science. It's the Catholic Church that actually does far more with the science here versus like, here, just take this pill and don't think about it. Right? You have to know and draw on the science and know the body. And so what you see here is a way of charting the temperature. A way of charting the cervix opening, mucus characteristics and sensations, and all of these things taken together. There's more detailed rules, but these, you're basically going to be able to put these things together and see when your peak day is. In other words, this is a time of ovulation. Why? Because you see, this morning you're down here. Guess what? The egg drops, and your temperature spikes the next day. Now this is something you have to chart this for a few months to kind of start to see. Again, in some people there's a regular pattern, others there's not. But even if you have, in some sense, irregular cycles, you're still going to see these things connected with fertility. It doesn't matter, even if you had a cycle where one cycle you ovulate on day 14, the next one you ovulate on day 21, you're going to see the same symptoms in terms of these three things, and understanding how this works. And so typically what this means is that if you follow natural planning, what you're going to see is there's a few days here where, okay, here day 6, day 7, you're probably talking infertile, day 8, day 9, you're starting to move into fertility, so there's a chance. Do you want to roll the dice? Get lucky or unlucky, depending on what you're talking or thinking about. Could be, same thing on this side of things, recognizing that there's less of a chance afterward, but some days up to 4 or 5 days ahead of time, right? Sperm can survive, and this is part of how God made our bodies, is that this increased fertility actually helps those sperm survive. So you can map it and track it this way. And this is a little bit complicated, so don't worry about this too much. If you have more questions, let me know. Or if you want my wife's number and want to talk to her, let me know. Because I can imagine. Anyway. But this really is something that I sometimes wonder, like, how much do people know about this? Like, I mean, whether you're single or dating or engaged or even married, I mean, this is kind of stuff that it's like, wow, like, this is how our bodies work. And I didn't know about this until about 6 years ago. So, in fact, I mean, I knew some of this, okay, guys. But there's a level of detail here that's like, oh, okay. Phase three, if you remember back, phase one is the first phase of infertility. Phase two is the phase of fertility. And then phase three is after fertility. And so this just gives a basic rule that phase three begins on the evening of, you know, if you apply these different rules and go back, you know, you're looking at the evening of the third day after peak day would then be, according to these signs, an infertile time. And so you could, again, if you're practicing natural family planning, engage in intercourse at that point. The research around this is that if you are trying to space children, and if you follow this, it is about 99% effective, which in some cases is better than other forms of contraception. Why? Because you're drawing on, you actually know when your body's fertile and when it's not. And that's much more reliable than in some cases just dumping hormones or using condoms or other forms of contraception that are not 100% effective. So I do say this in some sense jokingly, but in some sense seriously. Like, if this is something you want to know more about, let me know, and I can help connect you to other people who might know more, but also if you want to have more awkward conversations, we can talk about this. Here's another thing that I was thinking, though, that I think could be an interesting application of this, okay? Especially if you're a Christian couple who is trying not to have sex until marriage, I think it would be interesting to start tracking this, even for yourself as a woman, or even as I don't know, you know, maybe you don't want to share too much of this as a couple already, but what I think is interesting about it is, I mean, this is how God has made our bodies. Guess what's happening on peak day? Right? I mean, your body is saying, let's make a baby. Right? Right? This is how God has made our body chemistry. That if you have a significant other, their body is going to know that your body is saying, let's make a baby. And so, I mean, my wife and I struggle with this, right? We didn't want to have sex until marriage, but there are temptations, right? And so it might be helpful to know, like, everything in our bodies is saying, let's make babies. And so maybe this would not be the best time to put ourselves in a vulnerable position where we might be more tempted to that. Just a thought. I'm just trying to spread good news in the world.
In the Old Testament Levitical law, there are very specific prohibitions against having sex with a woman when she's on the period.
Yeah.
And it is not simply something which showed up in Leviticus and that was never seen again. One of the prophets mentioned it in conjunction with the horrors of these people who are sacrificing children and having sex with women when they're on their period.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of that is connected to the openness to procreation. And I mean, and even though this is not 100% true, but typically when a woman's on her period, right, you know that there is no chance. And so I think to keep that procreative lens in mind, I think that's part of why that's there, is to say there should at least be this openness to it. And that's another way of avoiding it, although not 100%. Again, there are instances where people have gotten pregnant. But it's, again, that's typically, when you look at how people have interpreted that, they connect it to that procreative aspect, thinking about it that way. All right, questions? I have so many. All right, so with that behind it, if you do have questions, let me know. But let's think a little bit about the article from Hollinger. And part of what I agree with, and what I really appreciate about this is he says that Protestants really haven't developed any kind of theological or ethical rationale for their use of contraception. That, you know, he charts the fact that this has changed, but it's largely just been a cultural shift that Protestants haven't thought through. And he says this is not very helpful in terms of actually walking us through practical guidance on this topic. Now, I think he's right about that. One question I did have, I'm not sure how much he actually, though, helps move this forward. He gives us a couple reasons, but I'm not sure that he really, I'm not sure how helpful this is pastorally in terms of giving guidance. One other thing that I wanted to note, I think he's mistaken in his description of Augustine and Aquinas. He says Augustine and Aquinas are the same and that they represent the majority Christian tradition, which is that procreation is the sole or the essential, the only, really, valid end goal for intercourse. And he kind of says, well, this explains why, you know, the Catholic Church was against it, because the only goal of intercourse is procreation. Once you start acknowledging, if that's the way you set it up, then once you start saying there are other goals, there are other ends or purposes, now maybe contraception isn't such a big deal. But I don't know why, but he just, because Aquinas is pretty clear on this, that there are three ends of intercourse, that includes procreation, unity, and pleasure, that all three of those are part of what is going on, but all three of those are valid. And so that, you know, so in Aquinas' perspective, from the way he sets it up, a couple can be open to procreation, but that doesn't mean, again, that if you don't have a baby as a result of this, that you somehow have sinned, or that, you know, something has gone wrong here. And so I feel a little bit like Hollinger has set this up in a way that oversimplifies the opposing argument. It makes it a little bit maybe easier on himself. The first argument that he gives is stewardship of nature. And I do think, pondering some of our previous discussions, it's interesting the way that he uses nature, if you pay attention to that and think about what that means, because he essentially says human stewardship involves intervention into nature. Right? He doesn't use the language of creation, not that I think he doesn't believe it, but it is just interesting to think about how modern people use this language of nature. That it's this kind of almost irrational force to be controlled, to be managed. Okay? So for him, human stewardship involves intervention into nature. Nature includes bodies. This is what I think is interesting. Nature, for him, includes bodies, but does it include minds? I don't know. Or does it include... So it's almost like there's this division even within the self between my body is a part of nature, but my mind or soul is part of this other reality. Therefore, most basically, human stewardship includes the possibility of contraception. And so it's basically this argument that says, yes, we can intervene, that I think, you know, most people, including human ABT, would not disagree with that. We can intervene, we can do this, and so this gives some moral validity to this. This is an argument, actually, that you see in the majority papal commission report. In fact, it's very positive about the human use of technology. It says, in creating the world, God gave man the power and the duty to form the world in spirit and freedom, and through his creative capacity to actuate his own personal nature. The story of God and of man, therefore, should be seen as a shared work. And it should be seen that man's tremendous progress in control of matter by technical means and the universal and total intercommunication that he has achieved correspond perfectly to the divine decrees. I especially highlighted this because I think this statement is very, in fact, overly optimistic about the human use of technology to control the material world. This almost seems to suggest almost that whatever we do fits perfectly with what God intended and with what God decreed. When in fact, I mean, even if you look at the biblical narrative, you have this sense that the people who, you know, develop the Tower of Babel, it's seen in their eyes as kind of this height of achievement, this height of civilization, and God, in fact, says this is a supreme representation of human pride, not, wow, this is the crowning event of human culture. In fact, he sees it as something quite different. And so I worry a bit that both for Hollinger and for this document, that it is a little bit naive about the human use of technology, right? Technology per se is not wrong, but it's also not inherently right. So we need to think about this. Now, I think he would say that human stewardship entails intervening in some things and not others. I agree with that. I think human habite would agree with that. I think the big question, though, is exactly how do we discern which things we should intervene in and which things we should not? This is exactly the point of human habite, that because the body is made this way, we are not meant to take a properly functioning body and interfere with that. Okay, so part of the issue is how do we have this criteria? So, for example, Hollinger in the article lists several things he says that we should not intervene in. He says we should not, he says a male-female distinction is not a permissible area of intervention. The fact that humanity is a distinct species means that we can't do, you know, cross-species experiments or other things like this. That you know, we're created in this way, we have these kind of kinds. Yeah.
What about using animal organs in place of human organs? Like, I know somebody who has a kidney.
Yeah. I don't know what he would say about that. But I think it's an area where it would seem to be a gray area that he does. I mean, that would be the question, if we can't do that, why not? Like, what makes that impermissible but makes some other things permissible? Yeah.
I was gonna say, and I would wonder what this author's position is, just because my book is talking about sexual identity and that whole type of thing, and one of the things that the author mentions is the thousands of people who are born with both male and female genitalia.
Yeah.
And how would the author kind of tackle that whole issue of, well, do the parents choose the kid's gender, or do you wait till the kid's old enough to choose their own?
Yeah.
Or what do you do?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a valid analogy, or at least it's an analogy that is pertinent to this discussion, and so I want to come back to it in just a minute. So he says, Hollinger says, you know, there are these several things that are not permissible areas of intervention, including procreation. So he's thinking more broadly in terms of saying procreation is part of how we're made, but it's more this principle of totality. You shouldn't interfere with that as a whole, but there are times when you would intervene in particular acts of intercourse. So he says contraception is a permissible area of intervention so long as the procreative context of sexual relations is maintained. I wasn't exactly sure what he meant by this phrase. I think he means male and female. And I think he means the context of marriage. So in that sense, marriage or contraception would be valid for married heterosexual couples, but not for anybody else. Although it gets a little bit interesting when you say, like, couples who aren't married should not use contraception, but couples who are married should. That seems a little, yeah, mind-boggling.
I kind of took it to mean that the procreative context, I took that as that at some point the goal of the sexual union will be procreative.
Yeah.
And the goal is to someday have children.
Yeah.
But not right now.
Yeah.
So, like, in this larger context of, yes, sex is meant for procreation and we intended to use it for that way.
Yeah.
But not every single instance.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think for him, I think he would affirm that principle of totality, that it has that. Now, one of the things I do think is interesting, though, this is where I wonder how this logic works. He says the natural cycle, okay, so recognizing this natural cycle that we've talked about, suggests that we are not at the mercy of nature alone in stewarding procreation. Why does he choose this phrase, at the mercy of nature alone? Right? Because again, I think part of what that does is it makes it sound like this is kind of an irrational force, irrational matter, irrational nature. And so nature sometimes does one thing and sometimes does another thing. And so I think the way that I take his argument here, he's saying because sex sometimes does not result in children, we have the right to intervene to ensure that it does not result in children. Right? Because sometimes it's natural that you're infertile. Therefore, I can impose my will to be sure that there are times when we're infertile, even when we are naturally fertile. Everybody following? And so here's where we come back to the analogy between the male and female distinction. Nature sometimes produces people that have genitalia that are both male and female. Does that teach us that it is okay, then, to intervene in our bodies in such a way that, you know, this is a potential argument you can make to say, even though someone has identified me as a male, maybe even because of my genitalia or other factors, I identify as a female. Therefore, it's legitimate for me to increase my levels of estrogen by artificial means and begin the process of transitioning to a female. Because nature teaches us that sometimes it's ambiguous. And sometimes it is a matter of choice. And so because nature teaches us that sometimes this happens naturally, that means that we can intervene to undertake that ourselves. Yeah.
I would like to point out that people being born with both types of genitalia or indeterminate is sort of something that doesn't happen naturally. It wasn't at all in the original design plan. It happens, but it happens in the same, like even the people who argue for transgender and all this stuff will not say that everything is right in the genetics of the people. Something isn't broken in the genetics, same as something's broken in the genetics of a child who's born with a malformed spine or something.
And that I think would be exactly why I think Hollinger's argument doesn't work, because when you talk about a natural cycle, you're talking about a normally functioning person. We're not saying, well, your natural cycle shows that something has gone wrong with you. Sorry, women. Right? It's just, you know. And so this is precisely the distinction that I think Human Abite or others would appeal to say, you know, you would make this male-female distinction. Why? Based on something you see or understand in Scripture as far as what's normative, but this is not, you know, these are two different kinds of things than that we're talking about. And so that this is just a question. How does he distinguish between what's normative, what shouldn't be changed, and what can be? What's good medicine and what goes beyond proper limits? I think there are some other implications here as well. If you try to follow this argument and think about where it goes. If you were to say, some couples are naturally infertile. Okay, so what do we deduce from that? Some would say fertility then is not an essential component to the marriage relationship. Now this is where I think we have to articulate this and be careful here. Because we wouldn't say somebody who is infertile somehow has less of a marriage. But I think we would say, again, something has gone wrong with how it's supposed to naturally function, which is why infertile couples struggle typically with that infertility. But others would push this argument the other way. Because some couples are naturally infertile, therefore couples who are not naturally infertile can choose to not have children at all. Right? Some married people don't have children at all. Therefore, it's legitimate for all married people to simply electively choose of their own will not to have children. More and more people are doing that, especially in North America and Europe. And that's why, you know, we're having crises like there are a lot of old people and not enough young people to take care of the old people. Why? Because the old people didn't want to have kids because it was inconvenient. They weren't good at long-term planning. Right? It's like it's really inconvenient to have children until suddenly it looks like trouble. I think a further implication for this, and in fact, Tony Campolo, who's a pretty well-known, I would say, evangelical author and speaker, made this argument when he came out with a statement in support of same-sex marriages. Says, look, I know a lot of heterosexual couples who can't have children, and so therefore, the fact that same-sex couples can't have children, that doesn't really tell me anything about the status of whether this should be called marriage or not, or whether this should be considered legitimate or not. And so we have to think carefully about the coherence of our position and of our stance, of where these things are going to lead us. All right, we didn't quite get through everything, but we came close. I'll see you next time on Tuesday.